From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Britain is up in arms about burqas, and London reacts to the Trump administration's latest Russia sanctions. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board. We're going to have a ball today because I am joined by Niall Gardner, the director of the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. He's the co-author of Margaret Thatcher on Leadership, Lessons for American Conservatives Today, with Stephen Thompson. He is also, of course, a Brit, here to talk about Britain. Welcome to the show, Niall.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Well, we're going to have some fun because we're going to talk about one of my favorite people. Former Foreign Minister Boris Johnson wrote in The Telegraph this week an op-ed titled, "Denmark Has Got It Wrong. Yes, the burqa is oppressive and ridiculous, but that's still no reason to ban it." So from my mind, kind of an anodyne op-ed saying if Denmark and other European countries are banning headgear, that's illiberal and I'm against it. And yet it has created an absolute firestorm in Parliament. Why is this issue so politically toxic, Niall?
That's a very good question. And it's, you know, the piece by Boris Johnson in The Telegraph earlier this week has been sort of attacked on, you know, on many fronts, actually, and it's caused an extraordinary controversy, even though the piece itself actually urges against a ban on the burqa, which is a policy that is in place, actually, in some European countries, including in places like France and Germany, Belgium, for example. So the ban is already, in place across many parts of Europe. It's not in place, of course, in the UK. And Boris Johnson was actually arguing against a burqa ban, but he was saying that the burqa is oppressive. It looks ridiculous. He compared, women wearing burqas to looking like bank robbers. And so this set off a firestorm of politically correct attacks on Boris Johnson, which I think are sort of coming from, a number of different, different quarters within the Conservative Party and outside of the Conservative Party. And I think that many are using this actually as an opportunity to bash Boris Johnson, of course, who was the Foreign Secretary until very recently. He resigned over the Prime Minister's very weak Brexit proposal, known as the Chequers proposal. And so a lot of the anti-Brexit forces within the Conservative Party are using this as an opportunity to try and tear Boris Johnson down, not least because he is the leading contender to challenge Theresa May, if indeed there is a leadership race for the Conservative Party
in the
coming months.
Two separate issues here. The first is the political aspect of this, and the second, of course, is the wisdom of the policy. So let's talk about the former first, since you raised it. I suppose it's no surprise to see the opposition Labour Party, which has been dragged, let's face it, to the crazy left by the leader, Jeremy Corbyn. No surprise there that they would be the moral arbiters, that they would pronounce themselves shocked, that anybody could criticize the burqa. But on the Tory side, Niall, this is what I find more interesting. Why
exactly
hasn't Boris had defenders?
I have to say, it's quite an extraordinary development to demonstrate just how far to the left some in the Conservative Party have moved. And you do have this ideological battle actually within the Conservative Party right now between conservative Thatcherites, Brexiteers, and more of a sort of, Tony Blair style politically correct, left that has gained some ascendancy within the Conservative Party. So there is this tremendous ideological battle going on right now, and in my view, some of the leadership of the Conservative Party, including the party's chairman, have moved far away from the original vision of Margaret Thatcher. And so this is a Conservative Party that has become increasingly politically correct. But this politically correct side very much, I would say, is on what we call the Remainer side of the Conservative Party, those who have not been in favor of Brexit. And Boris Johnson has been a leading figure on the Brexit side of the Conservative Party, and he represents a Thatcherite wing within the Conservative Party that is currently fighting a significant battle against the leadership of Theresa May, who's not an ideological conservative.
She's sort of a 70s era Tory party leader, someone who doesn't mind, I think, moving to the left to capture part of the labor base, just so long as it keeps her in power. And so this sounds to me, Niall, that you're arguing that the flap over Boris is really a proxy battle for this larger ideological struggle for the party's soul itself.
I think it is, and this is what it's all about. And so the left wing of the Conservative Party now mobilizing to try and damage Boris Johnson and inflict as much harm upon his reputation as possible in an effort to sideline him for any possible challenge actually to Theresa May's leadership. And so this is I think this is in essence what it's all about. But it's also, I think, about the rise of left-wing political correctness within the Conservative Party, which is a phenomenon that's been moving forward for many, many years. It really was elevated, I think, during the David Cameron era, and now it's being escalated even further in the Theresa May era. And there are many in the Conservative Party who feel, especially among the grassroots of the party, that the Conservative Party is becoming unrecognizable today in terms of its increasingly sort of politically correct approach.
And look, Niall, this has major implications for Britain because, as many of our listeners know, Britain has suffered several major terror attacks. The Muslim community has not been well integrated, I would argue, into the workforce or cultural institutions, social institutions of the country, civic organizations. And you finally, I think, have a Home Secretary in Saeed Javid who can start to talk about some of the trouble in that community and address it head on. And yet, if you have this kind of political correctness, how can Britain ever confront the problems that it has in this community if they can't talk about it?
Yeah, precisely. And you mentioned the new Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, who is a very robust Home Secretary. He's ideologically a very strong Thatcherite conservative. And Mr. Javid has not actually weighed in so far on this burqa issue, but I think his instincts will be much more in line with those of those of Boris Johnson. This is Home Secretary who I think is seriously challenging the Islamist presence in the United Kingdom, and there are other figures as well in the cabinet who I think would have a good deal of sympathy for Boris Johnson's position, including Michael Gove, the now Environment Secretary, who has been very hard line on the Islamist issue. And I would think that many members of the cabinet, without a doubt, would be very, very supportive, I think, of where Boris Johnson is. But you do have, those figures in the cabinet who owe their positions to Theresa May, who will be seeing this as, as an opportunity, of course, to sideline Boris Johnson.
Well, we also have to talk about the issue itself, because as you mentioned earlier, the UK has not banned the burqa, but France, Germany, Belgium, Austria, and now the Danes have. And I just tend to think, Niall, if you're at the point where you're banning pieces of clothing, you've lost the argument. It's almost beside the point, because it means that you have not convinced that community of the values of liberalism and women's empowerment and all of those other things. You have allowed them to really segregate off and to retain a lot of the practices that you would see in places like Iran or Syria or Saudi Arabia even.
Yes, it's a very interesting point you raise. So I think the British have traditionally been against sort of, you know, these kinds of bans. And I think that you're unlikely to see, I think, a burqa ban coming into the UK in the next few years. And certainly, you know, this government has ruled it out. The opposition parties are not in favour. But at the same time, I think that there is a growing backlash against, you know, the rise of Islamist extremism in the United Kingdom, which is quite widespread, of course, in many of Britain's largest cities, from London to Birmingham to, you know, to Bradford and Leeds up in the north. And the Islamist threat is a major problem in the UK, and the burqa is seen as a representation of this extremism. And so public opinion, I think, would be very, very much on the side of Boris Johnson's remarks that, you know, the burqa is a form of oppression, and it is against the the kind of, you know, British values that have been in place for centuries. But at the same time, though, as you know, as Johnson argues, the British have traditionally been against this kind of, you know, legislation banning what someone wears. But without a doubt, I think that Boris Johnson has struck a very, very raw nerve here with regard to the tremendous threat that Islamist extremism poses in the UK. And I think, if anything, this whole debate, this whole controversy, will significantly strengthen support for Boris Johnson within the grassroots of the Conservative Party. And this is very important, because if there is a leadership contest in the Conservative Party in the next few months, and I think there's a strong possibility there will be one, if there is a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister, if indeed that leadership challenge moves forward, and if Boris Johnson emerges as one of the final two contenders for the Conservative Party leadership, which is highly likely, then that vote will go to the grassroots of the Conservative Party, all of the Conservative Party members who will vote. And I think that Boris Johnson is way out in front among party members, who overwhelmingly back his comments on the burqa.
We're talking about the great big burqa debate in Britain. Say that 10 times fast. And you're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access. Only for WSJ subscribers.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. Podcasts from The Wall Street Journal. Check out all our shows at wsj.com/podcasts. That's wsj.com/podcasts.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel in New York with Niall Gardner of the Heritage Foundation in Washington. And we are turning to another topic tied to Britain. Earlier this week, the Trump administration announced new sanctions on Russia after determining Moscow had used chemical weapons in Britain in March against a Russian double agent, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter, Yulia. The announcement, made under a 1991 Chemical and Biological Weapons Control and Warfare Elimination Act. Niall, this is a direct line back to Britain. The United States, Britain, France, other allies, after that poisoning in March, took action, united action, to kick out spies, Russian spies, and send them back to Moscow. I mean, that's all well and good, but it doesn't really hurt Putin and his cronies. But this action, this additional action, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah, actually, these are very robust sanctions, and I think that even more robust will be the second wave of sanctions that will come in 90 days, unless the Russians can categorically demonstrate, prove that they are not using chemical weapons. So their facilities will have to be absolutely opened to international inspection, which is something the Russians are refusing to do.
That's never going to happen, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's never going to happen. And if the next wave of sanctions comes in effect, it's going to be a significant downgrading of diplomatic relations between the United States and Russia. It will mean the significant isolation of the Russian regime. And so these measures implemented by, or the sanctions implemented by the United States have been very strongly backed by the United Kingdom, who have felt at times that, there has not been enough strong support, especially in Europe, actually, for Britain in the wake of the Skripal poisoning by Moscow, which was an assassination attempt on British soil using Novichok, the second most dangerous chemical agent in the world, a chemical weapons attack on European soil. But most European countries, I think, have been supportive of Britain, but Britain feels that not enough is being done actually by Europe, and so this U.S. move I think is a huge boost to British efforts to strike back against Russia.
And yet the White House really was reluctant to take this step under U.S. law, even though it's been clear for months that Russia was behind this weapons of mass destruction deployment on British soil. And perhaps, Niall, it's because these sanctions are mandatory under this 1991 law. So the first wave restricts exports of national security sensitive goods and technology. That's the term that's used. But the second wave that you refer to, which is likely to come in, it's not just the diplomatic relations. This could include export, import controls, aviation restrictions. That's a big, big hammer. My question to you is, Niall.
Absolutely. Niall, these are very, very significant sanctions that will be a real blow, actually, to Russia on so many fronts, economic, diplomatic. It will significantly undermine, as you say, Russia's aviation industry. So these sanctions are much tougher than anything, for example, that the EU has put in place or is thinking of putting in place.
But why hasn't Britain taken stronger steps under the Theresa May government? Because let's be honest, Niall, these kinds of attacks have happened before on British soil. You've had polonium deployed. You've had assassinations. But for some reason, the Salisbury attack really has seemed to change the opinion within Whitehall and within Number 10 and within Parliament, I'd say, that we have to be stronger, that Britain must do more than just ejecting spies. So where's the British action? Where are the British sanctions?
Yeah, certainly the British reaction has been, on a larger scale than we've seen, as opposed to any previous Russian attack on British soil. It's important to bear in mind, I think, that this very reckless chemical weapons attack on Salisbury could have killed a large number of British people. At the end of the day, it killed one British citizen.
Dawn Sturgis, a mother of three.
Yes, but it could have potentially killed far more. And so I think that the sheer scale of the attack, forced a very strong response from from the United Kingdom in terms of the expulsion of diplomats and so on. But a lot more can be done. After all, the Russians have huge investments in the United Kingdom. You have a large number of Russian oligarchs, several hundred of them, operating in the United Kingdom, in London, with financial bases in the UK. Many of them send their children to British private schools. Britain is a second home for many of these oligarchs. And a lot more can be done in terms of cutting off Russian access to the British financial system, and making these oligarchs who help sustain Putin in power, making them pay.
Why hasn't it been done, Niall? What is holding back Theresa May? Because this does not strike me as a partisan issue.
Yes, I think that
and don't be diplomatic, Niall. Tell us what you really think.
I think the Prime Minister really needs to show some more backbone on this issue.
So she's weak.
She may be concerned about the impact on the British economy here. After all, there's a significant level of Russian investment in the UK. But I think she's got to be stronger and tougher, and she's got to follow Margaret Thatcher's example. I think if Margaret Thatcher were Prime Minister today, she would be a lot tougher on the Russians than Theresa May has been. Margaret Thatcher would have viewed Russia's actions as part of a much bigger war, basically, between Russia and the West and the free world. She would be investing far more in Britain's defences. And Britain at the moment spends just 2% of GDP on its defence. It should be spending at least 3%, ideally 4% of GDP on defence. And Britain has to be able to develop the military capabilities, if necessary, to fight a ground war in Europe against the Russians, which is what the Russians are preparing for. And the Russians have been massing troops close to the Baltic states now for several years, with one reason: to intimidate the West, intimidate the NATO alliance. And Britain must lead the whole of Europe in re-energizing Europe's defensive posture and ensuring that there will be a price to be paid if the Russians decide to offer any kind of aggression in Europe. So on many fronts, I think Britain could be doing more. I think with Theresa May, she's a prime minister who tends to do the bare minimum rather than going the extra mile. And, we are confronting, in terms of the Russian regime, a barbaric, brutal regime that is prepared to launch chemical attacks on European soil, that shoots down airliners over Ukraine, as we saw with the shooting down of
MH17.
298 people went down in that aircraft, including over 100 Dutch citizens. This was an act of terrorism carried out by the Russians. But what has been the European response? Barely any kind of response at all. We need to show strength and resolve in the face of Russian savagery and barbarism, and the British Prime Minister must be at the forefront of doing so.
Well, kudos to the Trump administration. At the prodding of Congress, I might add, California Congressman Ed Royce, who was pushing very hard for these sanctions, kudos to them for finally doing it. Let's end on a rare upbeat note on this podcast.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. My thanks to Niall Gardner of the Heritage Foundation for coming on the podcast today. I'm Mary Kissel with the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. You can tweet to me at Mary Kissel. I love your comments, even when they're critical. Have a great Friday, everybody, and we'll see you again on Monday.